Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the broth lady, or the inventor of the hashtag More Vegetables Than a Vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size, and self-love, and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Valentine, the PaleoMom.com. I'm the New York Times best-selling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up, and you get to listen to our gossip. Welcome to episode 132 of the Paleo View, everybody. I am
You just said the episode number in the intro to the show for the first time in 132 episodes.
Probably like the second or third. It's only because you actually did an outline and I'm looking at it.
We never say what number it is.
Well, it's an exciting number. I like numbers that match up. I'm a mathematic person by nature, as I'm sure you are. So anything where I'm like, you know, 1, 3, 2, you can do a bunch of math there and it all works out. I don't know. It's exciting. Welcome to 132, everybody, where new things happen. Like Sarah calls me instead of me calling her, and I say the episode number.
Right. Where we're trying to mix it up, you know, keep it fresh.
Got to do something after, you know, 2 years together.
132 episodes.
Yeah.
It's like we mean it or something.
And there are people that have listened to them all. And to those of you, I want to apologize.
I was going to say the exact same.
So, Sarah, I'm super excited about the show. And if you will give me a minute, I want to just kind of like introduce the idea of what we're going to be doing and where it came from. So we didn't really talk about my health stuff last week because we had Diana on the show and we were super into what we were talking about, homesteading and her new book. And if you didn't listen to 131, go back and listen because it's a great show. But I am going through some evaluative health stuff. And I, you know, mentioned before, I feel really great. I feel the best that I ever have in my entire life. And after your diagnosis of Hashi's, I finally got my butt into a doctor's office and was like, hey, can you test my blood work like for real, for real? And got a little more detailed and integrative than my regular physician that I'd been seeing the last few years, who just kept telling me everything was wonderful. And found out that I had a lump on my thyroid and went and we kind of joked on the podcast 2 weeks ago and I was like, well, obviously it's Hashi's because it can't be cancer and I don't have an iodine deficiency, so therefore it's Hashi's. Well, it wasn't as clean cut because when I went in for my ultrasound, it was suspicious and nobody ever wants to hear that. But I know that there are a lot of people that have heard that before or have even heard that something is cancerous. And so that was a scare for me for about a week while I waited for a biopsy appointment from my my ultrasound. And I found out earlier this week that it is benign and I have no concerns about the thyroid lump, which is really huge and exciting. Woohoo! No cancer is really exciting. not that I thought that I had cancer, but once you kind of hear the words suspicious, it gets
harder to knock out of your head.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
It's just always there until you hear.
So Sarah and I, in that week that I was waiting for my diagnosis, were looking at some of my, preliminary blood test results, and I have more blood test results and more things to go so that we can kind of dig into what might be happening with me, other than multiple autoimmune disorders, which I will tackle all in a post and talk about on the podcast once I know more. But one of the things that made me really concerned that I actually did have cancer is something that I've talked about before, which is that I have a high white blood cell count, and I have for a long time. And when I went gluten-free, it got a lot better. It went from looking like I had leukemia to not looking like I had leukemia, but turns out it wasn't exactly great either, which my regular doctor didn't tell me. And so when I had this additional blood work done, one of the things that they identified was that my liver function wasn't working very well. And for someone who has cancer, that could be a sign. And I was really concerned that I did have cancer because my liver didn't look very happy on my blood test results. So I'm happy to report that I don't have cancer, but on the other hand, that means that there's something else that is affecting my liver that's happening. And I had asked Sarah if she could dig into some liver stuff for me to help me understand my liver situation and how I could help support it as I take this next phase on in my life. And one of the things, I don't know, Sarah, if you'll get into it, that I actually found out in my own research was that this is very common for people without a gallbladder. So if you don't have a gallbladder, because I know a lot of people who follow me don't have a gallbladder, I would highly suggest that you get your, it's CBC and liver levels checked, right, Sarah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if it's common, and I'm reading that it's common, some of the things that we're going to talk about today could directly affect and benefit you if it is, in fact, something that you're not aware is happening to you. And I don't really have any symptoms other than blood work. You know, I'm not jaundiced. I don't have a lot of the things that they talk about with major liver problems, but that doesn't mean that it can't build up and get worse over time. So what I want to do is talk about how I can support my liver beneficially up front so that it doesn't become a problem long term. And so yeah, there's that. I'm like shaking. That was a lot. I don't know why I have such a hard time with like the personal stuff. It's so much easier just to write and like walk away from the computer.
And also I think it's really, really difficult. And it takes a lot of courage to talk about something in the middle of it. I think it's a lot easier for us as bloggers, as educators, as advocates to share a story once we have some resolution and we have that perspective that being, you know, having all those test results would give us. So it's kind of, I think it's just really, really challenging to talk about these things when we're still in the middle and we're still not quite sure what's going on. There's many different things that can be happening. And because we're still in the middle of it, there's, you know, we're in the middle of it, right? Like we're in the middle of like a weird health thing, and that's not something that we wish on anybody. And it just becomes, you know, a much more difficult thing to talk about in some ways, just because of the aspect of that sort of acknowledging that it's real and that it's happening and that there is concern, that there is, you know, more questions than there are answers. That's just a really hard place to be in. So I just kudos to you to have the cojones to talk about that in public, because I have had people commenting on like my Facebook and Instagram posts about how awesome it is that you have been sharing all of this. So like they tag you and they're like, I'm so thankful that, you know, Paleo Parents is talking about all this on the podcast, right? Like, I'm like, that's, you know, people really need to know that they're not alone. And yeah, one of the things that, you know, ends up being part of this discussion, like people who've been following us for a while know that we came to paleo from places of such extreme health problems, and paleo has dramatically improved our lives, but it doesn't undo magically all of the damage that being morbidly obese, and I mean, I was pre-diabetic, you may very well have been as well. You know, you certainly had all the other stuff of metabolic syndrome going on. I did as well. I mean, we came from these places of extremely poor health, extremely hard on our bodies, the way we were living, the way we were eating. And, you know, that there's, you know, it's like there's like scar tissue, and it may not actually, right, be exactly scar tissue, but that's a really good analogy for the damage that's built up in our bodies from the way we spent our first few decades. And it's one of, for me, the most frustrating things about paleo, because I look at how much I've improved, how much I've saved myself, how much I've learned, and I just wish I could go back and tell myself, right, as a young teenager or as a preschooler. Right?
That does you no good, though. You know what I mean? Like, that goes to the point that we talk about all the time about, you know, needing to stay positive and needing to reduce stress. Like, I mean, I know we all do that, but the less that we do that, the better off we'll be, because you're only causing, like, further internal damage by lamenting what you didn't do before.
The way that I channel that into the educational resources that I'm creating so that I can help other people get this information earlier. And then I channel it into my kids. One of the things that I actually talked with my pediatrician yesterday about was having both of my kids screened for Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And actually continuing to do that every couple of years, because it does, my mother likely has it. She's being tested now. My grandmother has it. And there's certain things, you know, my oldest has never been a particularly great sleeper, and she complains about being tired, and that could be a symptom. It could be also that she's just not a great sleeper. But you know, there's just enough of those sort of amorphous things. And that's the problem with Hashimoto's, is so many of the symptoms are really easily brushed off. And so, you know, I'm going to in part channel that regret that it took me 30 years to get diagnosed into making sure that if it's something that's going on in my kids' bodies, that we catch it as early as possible. So, so poor kids have to do a blood test now.
That's they'll be fine.
They have gone through worse. And so that's one of the things that I've got on my plate for the next few weeks. And
so this leads us into our positivity as it relates to children.
Educational resources.
Yes. So I'm super excited that this whole idea of how we were going to approach this show morphed into, some further ideas that I had for us to do this, and you summarized them in the scientific, nerdy, fun way that you always do. And you were like, I'd love to do a series on paleo myth busting. I'm like super excited to tackle this liver situation, and I will be straight up with you. Okay. There's some stuff happening on the internet that people are calling liver detoxes that make me really cringe. I did like a preliminary Google search on how to help support my liver and immediately texted you. And I was like, what is the junk versus what is the real stuff? Because there was one in particular.
Get off the internet.
Yeah, you were like, stop it. Because I found like one particular article that was like, someone told me I should drink coffee, that coffee supports liver detox. And you were like, no, it doesn't. Just get off the internet. So
And nor do coffee enemas. Just bust that myth right here. Because it's in a lot of liver detoxification protocols.
So,
and we're just going to.
What I think would be fascinating is to hear both your perspective on how to support the liver in an actually scientifically based way that seems reasonable for me to approach. Because when I looked at the vast amount of information that was out there and all the things that people wanted me to do, I literally was just like, that's it. I throw my hands up in the air. I've been on modified AIP for several years at this point. I've been paleo for almost 5 years. Like, if this isn't enough, then I'm done. Because I was reading about all the craziness with the liver detox, and I was like, I just can't. I just can't even. That's kind of where my brain was. So I'm looking forward to hearing your research-based, sensible approach to how to support your liver, while also having a lot of fun making fun of things that are just crazy and out there, like coffee enemas. And I'm really excited that you didn't tell me that that's something that I need to do, because that would be on the list of, I just can't even.
Yes. So, you know, I think that regular listeners of our show or people who regularly read my blog know that for me, because I was a medical researcher, I have a PhD in medical biophysics, you know, the way that I approach everything we talk about is, what does the contemporary science say? So as much as evolutionary biology arguments are what sort of brought me into paleo, to me, that's the hypothesis. It's not the proof. And the proof, you know, it's not just, I'm not just looking for these broad stroke, you know, double blinded random clinical trials with 50 billion people, which is, you know, one of these big complaints that paleo doesn't have a lot of, you know, large scale clinical trials pitting it against other diets. I mean, to me, those are great, but at the same time, they still don't really answer the question. To me, the thing that's missing to really answer the question of, does something work, is how does it work? And it is looking at the mechanism. So when I go through any, the way I tackle any problem is by looking at the medical research, looking at the evidence, looking at evidence-based science, and, but really, where's the mechanism? Where is the how and the why? So not just, does this supplement support liver function, but how does it do that? And when we don't know how something works, I'm typically very dubious, because not knowing how, like if you don't know that really important step of how something works, then you also don't know, you don't have any foresight into what problems might come up, what side effects there might be, what unintended additional effects there may be. And especially when you are doing a study that's very much a, does X supplement, you know, increase liver detoxification, they're not necessarily measuring what's going on in the kidneys or whether or not there's an effect on the cardiovascular system. And to me, when you are trying to so overtly manipulate a system, you need to look at the neighboring systems and figure out what the effects are. And it's something that we're going to talk about in other topics in our Paleo Myth Busting series, is this sort of whole body systems approach, and getting away from these really myopic viewpoints in terms of evaluating the utility of a particular strategy or a particular supplement. And I think that there's a lot of discussions happening in the paleo movement right now that are really, you know, pro some biohacking or pro some particular supplement that is really focused on how that biohack affects one particular system to the exclusion of the rest of the body. And I think that that really narrow point of view is going to get us into trouble. So when Stacy says, I want to do a liver show, my first thought was, like, do you want to do 10 liver shows? Because liver is a really complex organ, and it's going to take me a long, long, long time to go through everything. It just so happens that I studied the liver for my PhD, and I know a lot about it. But I thought that we should really focus this show into the issue of liver detox, because it is such a buzzword. It is, I mean, there's so many different, as you were saying, Stacy, like liver detoxification programs and protocols, and there's, you know, juice fasting and supplements, and then there's medical detoxes. And I've actually done a medical liver detox, so I've got that experience to bring to the table. And so let's kind of sift through what liver detox actually is, and how do we support that? And then we can kind of maybe get into some listener questions specifically about different detoxification protocols.
I'm glad I already got my listener question answered, in that I'm good on coffee and where where to put it and not.
Right.
Perfect.
And that you should not be dramatically increasing your intake.
I'm really proud of the fact that I don't drink it that often, so it cracked me up that I saw it as listed as something.
So the only thing that I could think of that would come from is that caffeine is a vasodilator, so it causes blood vessels to increase in diameter slightly, and that can actually increase blood flow. So it's actually why caffeine can be helpful for migraines, and it's why caffeine can be helpful for asthma attacks. Not that caffeine is like the magical cure for migraines and asthma attacks, everyone, but that is why it's sometimes packaged in with medications for those things. And so the only thing I could think of is that there, you know, the idea that if you increased blood flow into the liver, you could then, if your liver's really healthy and detoxifying appropriately, you could actually speed up liver detoxification that way. But that you've still got these other really important rate limiting steps that caffeine and coffee would have like absolutely no help in. And in fact, the way that coffee inhibits mineral absorption would actually hurt liver function. So that whole recommendation to me, I couldn't find any papers that would support that concept.
And of course, there were no references on the article that I found. So,
yeah, when you read a blog post that has no scientific references and they like are explaining science to you, then that is definitely big red flag should be going up. Especially these, you know, it's an entire genre of blog posts or of blogs that are have enough real science in them to kind of lure you in, and then they feed you the BS. And
that's spot on.
But it's true though, and it is so frustrating as somebody who's so meticulous with my scientific research to know that for the average reader, they can't tell the difference between what I'm writing and what these other, you know, people are writing, because to them, you know, the science looks the same. And it's why I started putting scientific citations in all of my blog posts like 2 years ago. Like, so I still haven't gone back to my really, really old ones to do that, but they're in all of the, you know, yeah, it was about 2 years ago that I started sort of making that a rule. Like, I have to differentiate myself from these like conspiracy theorist sites. If it sounds like conspiracy theory mixed with science, chances are really good that it's BS.
Speaking of science and setting yourself apart, give it to me.
Yeah. All right.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
Science. So what I thought would be really good if we're going to talk about liver detoxification is to kind of explain a little bit of how liver detoxification works. And this was actually a really interesting topic for me to research in more depth, because I actually learned some things and learned that I actually had a few things backwards in my head before. So it's always good for me to, I don't like finding out I'm wrong about something, but fortunately I was only wrong about some tiny small details and not about the end message with this. And so now I have the correct information to share. So most toxins in the body are fat soluble. In order for the body to eliminate them, it has to turn these toxins into water soluble compounds so that it can either go into So when the liver does this, it either goes into the gallbladder or it gets sent to the kidneys, and then the kidneys put it into urine. So it can either be excreted through feces because it gets secreted with the bile into the small intestine, or it can get excreted through the urine because the kidneys put it in the urine. And so in order to take this toxin and turn it from a fat-soluble molecule to a water-soluble molecule, it takes two steps in this chemical reaction. The first step is to take off the fat, and the second step is to put on a protein. And in doing so, you turn it from a fat-soluble molecule to a water-soluble molecule. So that first step where you take off the fat is called phase one detoxification. And that's, you know, done in the liver. And then the second step where you add the protein, or sometimes you add a little bit of a carbohydrate as well, that's called phase two detoxification. Now, what's really interesting is that you need phase one and phase two to be kind of working in concert together. There's a lot of different chemical reactions that can be performed that sort of qualifies phase one reactions. There's a lot of different chemical reactions that can happen that qualify as phase two chemical reactions, because it really depends on exactly what toxin we're dealing with. And there's a huge family of different enzymes that do that, orchestrate those chemical reactions and control them. But what's really interesting is that toxin, very typically, when you take off the fat before you put on the protein, it actually becomes even more volatile. And it's one of the reasons why it's so important for phase one and phase two liver detoxification kind of work in concert and work at very, very similar rates. But they also utilize some different nutrients. So as much as I like to talk about the immune system being like a huge nutrient hog, the liver detoxification process is also a huge nutrient hog. And in part, it's because of the huge number of different enzymes that are working to control these chemical reactions. And enzymes typically use a lot of minerals to control their activity, a lot of vitamins to control their activity. Part of it is the raw materials that are actually needed for these chemical reactions. And so there's a huge number of nutrients that are required by the liver to perform detoxification reactions. And when I started going through and researching to make a concise list, I kept finding these like infographics that would list like 10 nutrients. And it's the most partial list. And that it's so frustrating that we're like emphasizing the need for, you know, B vitamins and glutathione and plant polyphenols. And we have this sort of focus, like, here's all the things you need for phase one. And meanwhile, it's completely ignoring the different amino acids, fatty acids, and minerals that are required for those reactions. And I actually found it, the deeper that I researched it, the harder I found it to actually put together a really concise list of nutrients. And in part, that's because you're talking about the health of a whole organ. And so you're talking about the actual nutrients required as raw materials for that chemical reaction. So something that is going to potentially be incorporated into one of the chemicals. You're talking about the enzymes and what raw materials make up those enzymes, the cofactors for those enzymes. But then you're also talking about cellular health. You're talking about vascular health, because the liver is a highly vascularized organ, and the vasculature of the liver is in part designed. It has a really unique vascular structure that is designed to help bring these toxins to individual cells where these reactions can take place. And it's really designed to maximize the liver capillaries so that there's just, you know, millions upon millions of these individual channels where you can have, you know, one cell wide, you know, blood cells passing through. So I started to compile a list, and I will still share this list, but I want our listeners to really consider this as an incomplete list, even though I'm going to list about twice or three times as many things. So you'll see it on a lot of infographics. And in part, I want to sort of emphasize that there's certain vitamins and minerals that are just important for liver cellular health. So for example, long chain omega-3 fats are just really, really important for liver cellular health. And so they're really, really important for both phase one and phase two liver detoxification, because it's so important for the liver health, even if they're not explicitly used in a chemical reaction. And also there's a lot of overlap in terms of what's needed in phase one and what's needed in phase two. So phase one, liver detoxification, remember, that's where we're taking the fat molecule off of the toxin. This is where the B vitamins really have their major role. And in particular, vitamins B2, B3, B6, B9, and B12. And those are just really, really key. But also vitamin E, vitamin C, vitamin D3, calcium, zinc, copper, manganese, iron, selenium, germanium, molybdenum, magnesium, and sulfur, as well as branched chain amino acids and a huge variety of flavonoids. And these are sort of plant phytochemicals that are found in fruits and vegetables. And they are used in not just the chemical reaction, but also in many ways of controlling these reactions. In phase two, what we really add on top of those nutrients in terms of their necessity. And again, you know, the B vitamins play a role, sulfur plays a role, molybdenum again is a really important mineral, as is selenium and zinc. But now we start to get, it gets really, really important to get the amino acids in there. And some of the key ones are glycine, which we talk about a lot on the show because it's the fun, super awesome amino acid we get from bone broth, taurine, glutamine, N-acetylcysteine, methionine, and cysteine. And those are the amino acids that are then, or the components that are then stuck onto the toxin to make it water soluble. So that's why they come into play in phase two liver detoxification. And so when it comes to these herbs that support liver detoxification, most of them only support phase one. So they stimulate the production of the activity of enzymes that are doing phase one. And that can be a real problem because you don't have this then in concert, you know, phase one and phase two, so that you are limiting the amount of time that these toxins are actually more volatile once the fat has been released from them. So there's very, very few supplements that have been proven in the scientific literature. In fact, the only one that I can think of off the top of my head at the moment is milk thistle or silymarin, which is actually the active component in milk thistle, which stimulates both phase one and phase two. And actually, in terms of liver detoxification, nothing has matched the rigor in the scientific literature of silymarin, which has been really rigorously studied. But again, it's increasing the activity of these enzymes, but without the raw materials, your liver detoxification processes are still stuck. So when we talk about liver detoxification, we talk about the paleo diet being a detoxification diet. It's because it supplies all of these raw materials and allows the liver to self-regulate and self-control how it's going through detoxification. And it will do that efficiently when it has all of these raw materials, and if it's not too busy processing alcohol, processing a lot of sugar, processing an extremely high dietary fat intake, if it's not busy processing, you know, other types of, you know, drugs. And I mean drugs, but I also mean like Tylenol. If it's not busy, if it's not damaged from an infection, if it's not damaged from a parasite, if it's not damaged from, you know, tobacco exposure, yes, tobacco exposure does also hurt the liver, not just the lungs, or damaged from, you know, a history of something like, you know, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, chronic alcohol consumption. So really when we talk about detoxification, we are talking about providing the liver with these materials so that it can just do its thing because it knows what to do. It's a brilliant, magical organ and it's tasty. Just throwing that out there.
So I'm going to put you on the spot. You have a listener question here that's not on the page. Let's say you have this listener, Stacy, who wrote in and said she has IgA1 deficiency, which, as we've discussed previously on the show, means an inability to process and create amino acids efficiently. What I'm hearing you say is that that's essentially the function of phase two liver detox. So did you see anything in the medical literature that tied IgA1 deficiency to liver trouble?
No.
Okay. Does that make sense to you? Did I interpret that correctly?
It does not make sense to me.
Oh.
So selective IgA deficiency is a difficulty in producing a particular type of antibody. And as far as I know, the production of antibodies is a different enough process of protein formation than what is going on in the liver that I don't think that those two pathways would overlap in terms of regulatory enzymes or anything else going on there that would potentially cause there to be a link. The only link that I could think of would be inflammation. And then that gets back to just cellular health. So if you have selective IgA deficiency, you also have an easier time turning on nonspecific inflammation. And so that would be, I think, any potential link. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Hold on.
I mean, I could certainly look at it in more detail.
Okay, so this said, I have a link to it, but it's Wikipedia. It says, when you're deficient in making IgA, which is where people would properly utilize protective amino acids, proline and glycine, it's why I feel like I'm so positively affected by drinking broth, because it's adding additional protective proline and glycine. So how is that connection from the immunoglobulin translating into not properly utilizing amino acids?
Yeah, so I think what they mean is, so the IgA antibody is a dimer. So it's two copies of the same antibody, which sort of has this like Y shape, that are joined at the base of the Y, and they kind of make this like V of two little Ys. And that bridge connection at the base is rich in proline and glycine. And those, what happens in selective IgA deficiency is that the that bridge formation doesn't happen properly, and then basically the antibodies can't work because these particular types of antibodies work as a dimer. So it's really talking about the amino acid incorporation into that particular protein, which is the IgA dimer, and it's not talking about amino acid incorporation into proteins in general. If you couldn't incorporate glycine and proline into proteins in general, you would be a puddle of goo.
I don't want to be a puddle of goo.
Right. Like that would be inhibitory of life.
Okay. I'm just wondering if there's this deficiency in the ability to properly utilize those amino acids, how that ties in to the liver. Because it seems to me, from my own health perspective here, that the gallbladder is directly affecting phase one of liver detox, because it can't properly remove the fat. And so a lot of people who have their gallbladder removed also have fatty liver disease, non-alcoholic. There's like a, you told me what it was.
Non-alcoholic fatty liver
disease. Yeah, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And that doesn't necessarily tie to, eating crap. So for someone like me who has really good triglycerides, it's an indicator of the fact that I'm eating food that my body deems to be appropriate for it. But then if my liver isn't able to process everything that I'm giving it, It could be because of other things or whatever. So I'm just trying to get a bigger picture over my own health, because no matter how good your doctor is, you know, nobody knows you as good as you know yourself. And so I'm just trying to fully understand what is happening inside of my body.
so let me take a few steps backwards. So selective IgA deficiency does correlate with increased risk of autoimmune diseases. And that's probably because of IgA is basically, it is, its role in the immune system is really, really focused on gut. And what its primary job is as a sentinel type antibody in the gut. And so what the immune system actually does is it releases these IgA antibodies actually into the digestive tract. Then they're recycled back through the cells, and then they present whatever they found inside the gut to the immune system. And it's a way for the immune system to sort of sample what's going on inside of the gut to see if there's anything we need to get ready to fight. And so it's a really sort of clever system. And so one of the reasons why selective IgA deficiency is associated with autoimmune disease is because when you break down this really important sentinel system in the organ where 80% of the immune system is, you know, the immune system ends up getting blindsided by infection. And there's also potentially some role for gut integrity that is controlled by this system. So certainly having selective IgA deficiency increases risk of autoimmune disease. In part, it's because there's this like selective breakdown of one part of the immune system. And anytime you have that, you have this ability to, you know, non-specifically turn on inflammation, and then not be able to effectively fight an actual infection. When it comes to the gallbladder and liver health, so the liver actually makes bile salts, which are the components of bile. They're cholesterol-based molecules. And then the gallbladder stores the bile salts until after you eat. And then there's sort of hormone signals that go to the gallbladder to say, hey, you should secrete your bolus of bile into the small intestine right now. So there's a really, really strong link between liver health and gallbladder health. And often what happens is that gallbladder disease is diagnosed, but the root cause of that gallbladder disease is actually something that's going on in the liver. When your gallbladder is removed, your liver is still producing bile, but it's just basically constantly leaking into the small intestine. And then one of the things that happens when you have gallbladder disease before your gallbladder is removed is if you have clogged bile ducts, that's when that can cause a bit of a strain on the liver itself, because you've got this sort of like backlog of bile, like the bile is still being produced, but it's got nowhere to go. So that's why removing the gallbladder actually helps, because now the bile has somewhere to go and it just goes straight into the small intestine. You lose that bolus effect when you eat, which is why when you have your gallbladder removed, you basically need to take ox bile supplements every time you eat for the rest of your life, because there's no way you can you can achieve that bolus effect of bile salts into the chyme, it's called, but the material that's being digested naturally anymore without a gallbladder. So, you know, liver health and gallbladder health are really, really interlinked. And sometimes it's sort of like it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, but I think that generally it's far more common for there to be issues with the liver preceding issues with the gallbladder. But the liver is sort of this highly regenerative organ, and it's, you know, we don't just, it's so easy to just take out the gallbladder and fix that fix. I used air quotes there, and sort of fix that problem where you sort of have this organ that's sort of gumming up the works. You just take it out, and as far as the surgeon's concerned, everything's back to normal, and then you let the liver sort of regenerate and fix itself. But not having a gallbladder, that, as far as my understanding of liver physiology works, I don't see what the strain that would cause on the liver would be. I think the strain on the liver would be damage to the liver from before the gallbladder was removed, but after there was disease and blockage and gallstones and those types of things, as well as the inflammation and the general pathologies that were going on in those organs combined prior to gallbladder disease being diagnosed. And one of the things that I mentioned to you in our billion text messages over the last couple of days or last couple of weeks is that it's quite possible that this is damage to the liver that has been there for 10 years.
Yeah, no, I think it is. And I think I've mentioned this before on the show, and this is kind of where I'm going with the IgA deficiency. And I think maybe it all came together as you were talking, but I've had this immune system problem since I was a kid, like seizure inducing fevers, systematic infections, ear infections, bladder infections, kidney infections, bronchitis several times, pneumonia. Like I had never-ending list of infections as a kid, incredibly high fevers, like 107, 108, where I literally went into seizures. And so for me, the IgA deficiency made sense for that because you're more prone to infection and not a strong immune system response to fighting that infection with that particular deficiency. And when I went paleo, and especially when I went AIP and started focusing on nutrient density, and as you've heard me talk about a bazillion times, increasing broth, I have reduced that amount of systematic immune response tremendously. Like I know I've not had a bladder infection, a kidney infection, a yeast infection, even a fever that I can think of in the last couple of years. And I used to get them like every week. Like I used to get fevers just if the wind blew the wrong way and doctors couldn't figure it out because they would tell me, well, I mean, you just have a cold, you shouldn't have a fever, but that's how my body would respond. So I agree with you that I believe that the liver problem could be, over time damage. And it could also be something as simple as having celiac disease and going undiagnosed for 28 years could have affected my liver.
I think the biggest culprit is probably having been morbidly obese.
Yeah.
Because obesity does dramatically increase the risk of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is caused by extreme excess calories and sugar intake. And it is something that happens to people with morbid obesity and diabetes. And so, my guess is that is old damage that's just being looked at now. I don't know that that's a question that anyone will ever be able to effectively answer.
Yeah. And just so listeners know, I have not yet been diagnosed with liver disease. I just know that my liver is not functioning as it should. And my doctor has informed me that the only thing that can diagnose fatty liver disease, whether it be alcoholic or non-alcoholic, would be a sonogram. So that's not something that I have yet done, but it's something that I might need to do after the next test of blood results. But before those blood test results came in, I wanted to be able to speak liver. So yes. Why don't we jump into listener questions?
Since we're at a cut point,
yeah,
or you can include this if you want. I also want to emphasize that your liver numbers were actually really, really mild on the scale of liver problems. So I know that you saw the little H beside the number when you got your blood test results. You're like, I'm outside of the reference range. My liver's dying. but your liver was actually, those numbers were really low. And they could have just as easily been just evidence of increased inflammation, which could be caused by any number of different things. And so what was really, really important about your liver numbers, so your AST and your ALT were high slightly. They were like only slightly above the – like when the liver is really bad, those numbers are in the thousands. So just to give you some
perspective, that makes me feel better,
right? So your numbers were just barely out of the reference range, And basically that measures the main cell type in the liver. They're called hepatocytes. It actually measures cell death. AST is not a great measure, but ALT is a very, very specific measure for liver cell death, because it's actually an enzyme that is only found inside liver cells in the body. And so having a raised ALT does point to cell death in the liver, but that can be caused from, you know, inflammation, from, you know, stress, from an infection. Like, there's so many different things that can cause that. And the liver is a highly regenerative organ and is able to fix itself very, very quickly. Your bilirubin numbers were completely normal. So those are the functional. So the AST and ALT measure basically whether or not you've got liver cells dying. Bilirubin is the functional measure. And so if your bilirubin is elevated, that means your liver is starting to not function appropriately, because bile is leaking into the blood instead of bilirubin is a component of bile salts. So it's leaking into the blood instead of going into the gallbladder or getting shunted directly into the small intestine. Your bilirubin was entirely normal, which means your liver function is entirely normal. So, you know, as much as we're doing an entire liver focused show, your liver test results were pretty like, yeah, we should figure out what's going on. But like, it was really, really minor.
Well, thank you. And I think it's also why I want to see if there's anything else I can do lifestyle-wise. And I think you alluded to one of the things that I think that I can focus on, which is stress reduction and lifestyle factors. So I'm also getting an adrenal cortisol. I did my spit test of awesomeness. And I highly suspect, like 98% positive, that that's going to come back not within the normal range, because I'm an extremely stressed out type A personality.
What will be fascinating is to find out if it's high or if it's low, because I think those things actually feel very similar. And I had low, and then when my adrenals came back on, I had high. And it's been a really interesting experience, because I can't tell you from how I feel. I can just tell you that it's not right.
Yeah. Well, there are certainly like symptoms that I can point to that would say, yeah, no, that's not. And I've always known that. But then at the same time, I'm like, this is who I am. So, you know, looking at kind of medical solutions as to how to do that. But also, this past week or two, I have more so than usual just kind of said, the heck with it on a lot of things. Like, normally
you went bowling.
I went bowling. I went to bed really early and I felt like an old woman, and I either worked out or I didn't work out, and I didn't care either way. And I had a glass of wine, even though I found out that my liver wasn't ideal. And I just kind of was like, I mean, I didn't have like, you know, 18 glasses of wine, but at the same time, what I feel like for a lot of us, and we've talked about it, Sarah, I think even in the recap of the Paleo View tour, because it was something that happened so often, is that we meet women with these kinds of problems who take it upon themselves to be so stressed out and overwhelmed with the health conditions and trying to solve them that it actually can create more problems than it helps. And I think I might have been at that point. Like, I might have, you know, said to myself, I need to do these things, and I need to not drink, and I need to not consume treats, and I need to train, and I need to do this, and I need to do that to get on track. That it's very easy for those of us with that kind of personality where we feel like nothing we do can be right, and you're just constantly at a level of stress that's not normal. And it's very outside the confines of my comfort zone to not be in control and to be okay with things not being perfect. And you and I talked about that in a text message about like having a problem with needing to make everybody happy all the time, and how that's physically impossible. And therefore you're like stressing yourself out with no recourse. So those are the kinds of things that I'm working on, even though, you know, I talked before about when I went AIP, doing lifestyle things, and I had already kind of hired a team on the blog and done things to reduce my personal overall stress. But what I'm working on at this point is not outside factors, but inside factors, like telling myself it's okay, it doesn't matter. It's okay, it doesn't matter. And that is going to take some time for me personally to adjust to, because I am the type of person that takes names and kicks booties. And you can't do that if you're constantly telling yourself that it's okay to not do that. So it's kind of walking a fine line for me right now.
That's awesome. Let's do some questions.
Yes, let's talk about someone other than me.
Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
All right, so our first question is from Andrea. I've been researching a liver detox protocol. The book is The Fast Track One-Day Detox Diet by Anne Louise Gittleman. And she's got a link for an article that sums up the diet that we can definitely include in the show notes. It's not strictly paleo, but I can avoid the things she suggests that won't fit, like psyllium husks. My goal is to be able to heal my liver after years of eating CRAP and support both my liver and colon to do their jobs more effectively. I haven't heard much in the paleo community about taking such actions, so I wanted to get your take on it. Good idea or bad idea?
Well, I haven't read about the actual diet, so I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are based off of what's included in the diet. I'm assuming that if it's coffee enemas, it's not going to be a good idea.
It actually does not include coffee enemas. So I was like so skeptical when I went to have a look at what this protocol actually entails. And then when I had a look at it, I was like, oh, well, in many ways, this mostly makes a lot of sense to me. You know, generally, I think that what I tried to allude to in the Science with Sarah segment is that the best thing that you can do to support your liver is to eat plenty of the nutrients required by your liver to perform its duties. And that includes the most nutrient dense foods that we are always talking about on this show: organ meat, seafood, and vegetables. And so when you eat those foods, you are basically getting everything that your liver needs to do its job. And so one of the things that I really liked when I actually looked at this Fast Track Liver Detox was that it actually really has that built in. So it has a week where you're eating a lot of vegetables, and it's divided into the different vegetable groups. So you're kind of automatically eating the rainbow, but you're getting a lot of cruciferous vegetables, which are high in sulfur, but also high in a lot of the specific flavonoids that are used in liver detox. A lot of green leafy vegetables, citrus, which has a lot of really, really important nutrients that the liver uses for detoxification. Further sulfur-rich foods, so they're suggesting radish family, garlic, onion family, eggs. And then they also suggest, interestingly enough, foods that stimulate phase one liver detox, which that's the part where I'm kind of like, that part maybe not so great. And then at the same time, doing like a colon cleanse, which basically meant like eating a lot of like psyllium husk or flaxseed or fruits that make you poop, and then drinking ridiculously large amounts of water. So part of it kind of made some sense to me in the sense of like eating more of these foods that were really super high in nutrients. The colon clearing aspect of it, I'm not entirely like, to me, I think that a normal diet should support gut health. And when you do something that is specifically designed for clearing out the gut, if you have something like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, then you're going to see some benefit from doing that. But if you have been following a great paleo diet this whole time and you've been eating lots of vegetables, all you're basically doing is committing mass genocide if you're happy little gut bacteria pets. And so that's generally
it's one
not
of my favorite
cool
things you say.
So, and then it also has like eating quality proteins, eating fish, and eating, taking oil supplements that are particularly oils that are high in polyphenols. So all of those things are like focusing on the nutrients that are really important for liver health. And then it has a list of things to avoid, which are all the things that are really, really hard on the liver, because the liver has to stop its detoxification reactions in order to handle excess sugars, excess dietary fats, artificial sweeteners, alcohol, caffeine. It also is gluten-free. This particular diet takes out refined carbohydrates. So a lot of things that you would not be eating on a paleo diet anyways. And then this diet does a one-day juice fast, with a juice that's basically a whole lot of vitamin C and some spices that can stimulate liver detoxification. And then there's a recovery period where you're consuming probiotic foods to help build up gut bacteria again. So they suggest sauerkraut and yogurt. And doing, actually, interestingly enough, some supplements to support digestion. So like taking hydrochloric acid and bile salts with your meals. So it's kind of an interesting protocol, because I feel like it's got some pieces that, you know, like certainly if somebody was telling me that they, you know, they had symptoms that would indicate sort of sluggish liver detoxification, you know, I would say, A, I'm not a doctor and you need to talk to your doctor about this. But what the literature would say is that, you know, increasing nutrient density and then supporting your digestion and working on gut health are like the big things that you could do. And a lot of that is built into this procedure. That being said, you know, part of this question is like, are liver detoxes even a good thing to do? And, you know, my general statement is no. I mean, I think it's one thing if you are working with a really astute functional medicine specialist who's got some test results, who thinks that a clinical detox program, which is entirely supplement based, on top of your outstanding diet, your focus on getting enough sleep and stress management, you know, I think if you're kind of going that route, that's a very, very different situation. You've got medical guidance, you've got medical supervision, you've got test results that are pointing to it, and you're doing the other things. But I think that really the best thing that all of us can do for liver health is basically live this nutrient dense part, right? As part of the liver detox, which is basically providing our livers with everything it needs. And then, you know, the lifestyle things, you know, detoxification reactions happen more when we're asleep. They happen more when we're not so stressed, when we're not stressed out and our stress levels are low. So keeping stress low, getting more sleep, getting some activity, all of those things feed into to liver health. So I think that, you know, in terms of protocols, I have seen, you know, 90% of them out there are far, far worse. There's definitely some intriguing things built into this. But I think that the vast, vast majority of people just need to eat some nutrients.
So, Sarah, I don't know if you're going to cover this in your answer to the next question, but how do you feel about juicing to support liver?
I was going to cover that in my answer to the next question.
Go ahead and read the next question then.
So the next question is from Stephanie. Hi, I love your podcast. And as we've said many times, telling us that you love our podcast is a surefire way to get us to answer your question.
Especially when it's on topic.
I have a general question regarding liver cleanses and flushes. I value your opinions and have followed your blogs and podcasts for a while. Recently, a friend was interested in a cleanse and I couldn't remember either of you discussing it. What are your thoughts and or experiences? Do people need a cleanse despite sticking to real food? Thanks.
So I'll just give you my thoughts on the matter, which is that for people who say that they feel better juicing, or this idea of cleansing, I would point to your answer to the previous question, which is that if you're eating a nutrient-dense diet, You're going to get synergistic response on the foods that you're eating. And that is the way that I would like to approach supporting my liver. If you tell me, Stacy, it's obviously not enough that you are eating soup and salad and you need to eat more fruits and vegetables, and I can't cram enough in into my food consumption, then I would consider that. But I think in the case of most people that I'm learning about in this liver support process, I see a lot of people replacing the vegetables that should be, I don't want to use the word should, the fruits and vegetables that would be supported by a healthy diet in general in their, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner plates, and replacing them with a juice. And that concerns me because we've talked before about blood sugar and fiber and that sort of thing with juicing. And that doesn't change just because you need to support your liver. As you've talked about before, like, there are trade-offs as to some systems that you could be affecting by thinking that you're helping another. So that's my answer, and I'm sure you'll take that ball and run with it.
Totally. So, you know, someone asked me once, like, why do you, like, did you see the movie Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead? Brilliant documentary. Loved that documentary. And in part, I love that documentary because it was so well done. Like, it was such a compelling argument when you saw these two really, really sick people change in front of you and their skin clear up and start to glow. And the one man just watched the weight melt off of him and just see his energy skyrocket. And you cannot, I mean, there's actually, I just was reading a scientific study that was just published last week that actually says that that people are far more likely to get to try a new diet or be influenced into, you know, trying some kind of new exercise regimen or whatever if they have someone in their peer group, your friend or family, who has done it and had success. And that has a far bigger impact on whether or not they're going to do something than whatever advertisements, whatever books, podcasts, whatever other educational materials they might run into. And so the reason why this documentary was so brilliantly well done is because you found yourself emotionally invested in these people on the screen and watched them get healthier and healthier and healthier. And so I get asked, you know, like, why was juicing so amazing for them? And I think there's some really, really important things that are happening with juicing coming from a standard American diet. One is many people on a standard American diet have gut dysbiosis, including overgrowth. And whether that's small intestinal overgrowth or large intestinal overgrowth is sort of varies by individual to individual. And so what happens when you're juicing and you're removing all the grains, you know, when you're juicing, it's gluten-free. You're taking out all the legumes, all the things that are super hard to digest that are feeding that overgrowth. And it's why people tend to have diarrhea when they juice, is because you basically stop feeding your bacteria and you have sort of this mass die-off. But it's when you're coming from a standard American diet, and especially when you're coming from a bad standard American diet, you're having this tremendous immediate benefit from that die-off because you're killing off an overgrowth and you're killing off, you know, skewed types of bacteria. And then at the same time as you're doing that, you're dramatically increasing nutrient density because you're going from the vitamin and mineral equivalent of a couple of servings of vegetables a day to the vitamin and mineral equivalent of 30 or 40 servings of vegetables a day. And that is a huge amount more vitamins and minerals to be getting compared to where these people were coming from the standard American diet. But the reason why juice fasts are supposed to be sort of at most 10 days is because there's nutritional deficiencies built into a juice fast. There are nutrients that you're not getting. And that if you continue to starve your bacteria in your digestive tract, eventually you have undergrowth, and that doesn't help either. And so you're supposed to, if you did a juice fast, you're supposed to do this for a short period of time. And then you go back to a nutrient-dense diet that includes lots of fruits and vegetables as food for your gut bacteria. That's what the paleo diet already is. So when you're coming from a paleo diet, like, why would you do a juice fast or a flush or a cleanse, which they all have sort of similar, you know, exactly what the components of your juice sort of varies. And maybe there's a supplement, or maybe there isn't, or maybe it's full of, you know, these herbal teas. When you've got a diet that's already really, really amazing for supporting a healthy diversity and healthy numbers of gut bacteria in your gut, and is already providing your body with the nutrients that it needs to have that beautiful glowing skin. And so, so juice fast, you know, there's some things in it that you really, when you think about it, are quite similar to paleo if you're coming from a standard American diet, because it is this sort of massive influx of nutrients. It is typically lower sugar than what people are coming from. And it does have some pretty dramatic influences on gut bacteria. But when you consider it sort of next to the paleo diet, there's some real problems. And one of them, Stacey, you alluded to, is the fact that when you juice vegetables, the sugars, and even if it's not fruit in your juice, the sugars are much more easily absorbed into your bloodstream. And you're not getting anything to regulate that blood sugar absorption. So the fiber in fruits and vegetables typically regulates the absorption into your bloodstream of the sugars. And then when you consume it as part of a meal, the fat and protein also helps regulate your blood sugars. So on a juice fast, you are getting these spikes of blood sugar every time you have a juice. And if it's got fruit in that juice, it's even worse. And then you're missing out on the fiber, which has so many benefits. I mean, this is already a long podcast, and I don't even know if I can like condense the benefits of fruit and vegetable fiber concisely. I can say that it helps with detoxification reactions. It helps regulate hormones. It helps control hunger hormones. It helps create the right balance of bacteria growing in your gut, which themselves then influence the immune system, the integrity of the gut barrier, even your brain health and your neurotransmitters. So fiber, it's not considered an essential nutrient, but I think that that's a mistake. And I think it really should be considered an essential nutrient because of how vital it is for our health. So when I see people have juices in place of other vegetables, if it's in addition to other vegetables, I really don't mind. Sometimes I like to have a vegetable juice instead of an electrolyte juice when I'm at CrossFit. Or sometimes that's if I have a cold, that's something I will drink, but it doesn't substitute my other vegetable intake. It's in addition to my other vegetable intake. And so I think that's a very different way of approaching it. And I think when it comes to, you know, liver cleanses and flushes and colon cleanses and flushes, which is a whole other topic, you know, I really just think it's like, just eat nutrient-dense foods and eat organ meat and seafood and vegetables and have those as part of, you know, a big part of your diet. And then you don't need to be like going to these extremes to find health. You know, I think it really comes down to nutrient value.
Truth. I'm on that soapbox with you.
Good. It's not me. So that was like, my cheeks hurt blah, 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 from talking so much. I'm making a fishy face now. Can you hear it?
I can hear it. Okay, so here's the thing. I think that we have reached like a new level with the podcast, and I want to give you a high five. Here it is. I'm marking it. Episode 132. I feel like we have really kicked it into gear, and I am enjoying listening to this podcast.
Maybe we should ask our listeners if they like the High Gear podcast.
Yeah. Just like we did with our, what do we call that series? Philosophical, paleo, Philosophy series. If you enjoyed Paleo Mythbusters 101: colon liver cleansing, let us know, because we've got a list of additional topics that I asked Sarah to myth bust on. And if you want her to, you know, rest up her cheekbones the day that we record so that she can get into some of the science and bust these myths on future topics, let us know. And we would also really appreciate either refreshing your review on iTunes or leaving a new review on iTunes if you're a new listener and haven't heard from us, or Stitcher. I have no idea what happens on Stitcher, but we're on Stitcher. So if that's something that you're listening to us on and they do reviews there, please put one in as well. We appreciate and read all of them. And
also feel free to leave comments on our show notes posts on either of our blogs, or absolutely, if you have, you know, additional questions or just want to also give us virtual high fives. Those are always appreciated. I'm just saying.
I mean, because as much as we like each other, sometimes the self-inflicting high fives gets a little old. So I really enjoyed the show, and maybe it's because we just talked about me the whole time, but
but it was you plus science.
Well, yes. And honestly, this is as probably won't be a shock to our listeners, there's a number of topics that we've been hesitant to tackle because we want to do so in a respectful, educated sort of way. And things like liver detox can be very broad-reaching and difficult to get your arms around in that sort of capacity. So thank you, Sarah, for tackling this for me today, because I know that it was a bag of worms, and I think you did a great job. Thank you.
Thanks, man. It was more fun than I anticipated, because at first I thought, oh, man, not a liver show.
At first you were like, Stacey, you can't have some other health problem.
You're done. You're done having health issues so that we can have normal, light, airy-fairy podcast.
Well, the good news is I feel great, so.
That is good news. That's awesome news.
All right. Well, thank you again for tuning in. We'll be back next week with probably another Paleo Mythbusters show. And if not, you'll come up with something else, Sarah.
Absolutely. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
I just did a lot of
I know, but I'm
serious brushing up on phase one versus phase two liver detoxification. It's fascinating. I am not joking. So I have a book open. I have a page of notes. And I have a PDF and four tabs. This is the like spread of like different bits and pieces I'm pulling together. The sad thing is that because it's not a video podcast, you don't get all of the visual.
Sorry, you don't want to see what's happening over here, because it was a long weekend and then it was a snow day, and I pretty much haven't changed or showered like that entire time. No, I mean, maybe once.
My hair looks really, really good today. It would be a good day for me to be on a video podcast.
Although, I cannot say the same.
I probably look a little bit like Senator Palpatine with the bags under the eyes, but